Good afternoon. It's nice to be able to be with you all this afternoon. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, Paul is coming to the close of his discussion of how the church ought to conduct itself in the assembly. Particularly in the 14th chapter, he's focusing on two miraculous gifts, that of speaking in tongues and the gift of prophecy. He points out throughout the chapter that as long as there's no interpreter, prophecy is better than tongues, simply because when you utter in a tongue, although it glorifies God and may edify you, it does nothing for anyone else because they can't understand it. If you have tongue speaking with an interpreter, it's functionally equivalent to a prophecy, and then you've got something that edifies. What I think is interesting as you go through that 14th chapter, and as we introduce our subject this afternoon, is that six times Paul refers to a specific concept. He first mentions it in 1 Corinthians 14, verse 3. He says, he who prophesies speaks what? Edification and exhortation and comfort to men. In the next verse, he says, he who speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but he who prophesies edifies the church. He said it twice now. But he who prophesies edifies. Verse 5, I wish you all spoke with tongues, but even more that you prophesied, for he who prophesies is greater than he who speaks with tongues, unless indeed he interprets, that the church may receive what? Edification. Again in verse 12, even so you, since you are zealous for spiritual gifts, let it be for the edification of the church that you seek to excel. Number 5, verse 17, for you indeed give thanks well, that is, if you're praying in a tongue, but the other is not edified, and that's a problem. Verse 26, finally, after describing an assembly where there are many people involved, he closes with, let all things be done for edification. Edification. My subject this afternoon has been entitled Church Etiquette, and I think this is the best place to begin. For when the church comes together, Paul has said repeatedly that the goal is edification. Now, what's edification? Well, what is edification?
Building
each other up. And that is what these words mean. There are actually two Greek words behind these. I believe it's a noun and a verb. They look like this in English characters. Oikotome and oikotomeo. And you look them up and you'll hear just what you said. The process of building or construction, figuratively, of spiritual strengthening, edifying, building up. To construct a building, to build, to help improve ability to function in living responsibly and effectively. Strengthen, build up, make more able. We use the expression edifice in our language. We refer to a building or a home as an edifice. When you edify, you're edifying the edifice, you're building up the building. Now, what building are you building up? Church. And the church, the house of God, 1 Timothy 3:15, is made up of individual houses of God. For what did Paul say? If you're a Christian, in you dwells the Holy Spirit, you are the temple of God. So each individual temple is growing together into one holy temple in the Lord. Ephesians chapter 2. If you're a yogurt eater, you may have noticed this expression right here, O-I-K-O, I've seen in the grocery stores, oikos, yogurt. It's the Greek word for house. When you're edifying, you're building up those who are houses of God. Now, how do you edify? How do you do that? Well, Paul said in the 8th chapter how you do it. Knowledge puffs up, but what? Love edifies. And notice if you're in that 14th chapter right now, how he begins it. The first thing Paul says in 1 Corinthians 14 is, pursue love. If we want to build up one another, we have to love one another. Love is at the heart of edification. Not just good preparation, not just in so-called enthusiasm. Love is at the heart of edification. And no amount of preparation for a lesson, no amount of good dress, no amount of a nice facility, no amount of all these things will make a bit of difference in the eyes of God, ultimately, if they are not motivated by and governed by love. And by the way, love is not rude. So if you've got love motivating things, you'll be abiding by church etiquette. You'll be minding your manners. So I was given a number of things by the congregation to possibly consider. I've kind of categorized them in three areas. And some of them may seem interesting and important to you, and others may seem peripheral and unimportant. But we're going to talk about them all because they were important to someone. We're going to begin with respect to church etiquette with the building itself, the meeting house. I assume we all know that in the first century, it does appear, we have no indication in the New Testament, certain indication anyway, that the churches had meeting houses like we have now. We know they had them by the end of the second century when Domitian began his persecution in Rome. They were burning down buildings. But prior to that, in the first century, where were the churches meeting? Well, among other places, they were meeting in homes. At least three, if not four, congregations in the New Testament are specifically stated to have been meeting in homes. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 19, Paul's probably writing from Ephesus, and in that passage he says, "Aquila and Priscilla greet you heartily in the Lord with the church that is in their house." Romans chapter 16, verses 3 and 5, he says, "Greet Priscilla and Aquila, likewise greet the church that is in their house." It looks like Priscilla and Aquila may have had church in their house in two different locations, possibly. Colossians 4:15, Paul says, "Greet Nymphas and the church that is in his house." Philemon 1 and 2, Paul writes to Philemon, our beloved friend, and to all those others he mentions there, and to the church that's in your house. Now, what bearing does that have on the question of how we handle and relate to the meeting house? Well, I think it may have some bearing simply because issues come about concerning the meeting house for one basic reason to begin with, because we have one. If we were in the first century and meeting in homes, I think it's very possible that many of the issues that bother some of us about the meeting houses would not exist, because there'd be no reason for them to exist. You'd be walking into someone's living room, or as I've had experience, you might go to the gymnasium, you might go to the prison and have church with the prisoners there, you might even do it in someone's garage. And a lot of the things that bother us and get us worked up sometimes might not even arise. But we do have the meeting houses, and questions do arise, so let's talk about them. Questions like the following. Jesus referred to the temple as a house of prayer when the money changers were polluting it through their lurid business. Is it possible that our meeting houses should be regarded with similar respect? Or, God or the angel of the Lord was present at the burning bush, and when Moses approached the bush, what was said from the bush? What did the angel of the Lord say? The place you stand is holy ground. So where God was present, it was holy ground is the thought. Therefore, if the Lord is among his people when they gather, is it possible that that is holy ground? These two questions kind of go together. I have to admit, and I don't want to be the guy who stirs the pot unnecessarily, but I personally struggle with questions like this because, well, perhaps one of the reasons it's difficult to have much to say about it, for the New Testament doesn't say anything about it. The New Testament just doesn't address this question. I understand it's a legitimate question and it genuinely concerns people, and I honor it from that standpoint, but it's just not something the New Testament has a lot to say about. The Old Testament, there was holy ground in Exodus 3, there was holy ground in Joshua 5, there was a holy place and a most holy place in both the tabernacle and the temple. But when we get to the New Testament, the only New Testament references to a physical, geographic location that is holy have absolutely nothing to do with where the church meets. Jesus appears to have called Jerusalem the holy place. In Matthew 24, verses 15 and 16, when he's describing the coming destruction of Jerusalem, he says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, run." You get over to Luke, in Luke 21, verses 20 and 21, he says, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, you know this desolation is near. Then you, those who are in Judea, flee to the mountains." It looks like Jerusalem might be the holy place, but that's certainly not where the church is meeting, strictly speaking. Peter referred to the Mount of Transfiguration as a holy place in 2 Peter 1:18. Jesus was there. God was there. I can understand why he would refer to that as the holy mountain, pardon me. We have in the New Testament heaven being called the most holy place. We can read in the New Testament where Christians' bodies are holy, where your children are holy, where your kisses are holy, your conduct is holy, your faith is holy, your spirits can be holy, but nowhere, as far as I can see in the New Testament, does the Bible ever ascribe holiness to the place where Christians meet, even with the Lord being present, according to Matthew chapter 18, verse 20. If there's a holiness there, it's not stated, and it's not stated to be like the holiness of the temple. And do you really want to treat the meeting place like the temple was treated anyway? I don't know how far we'd be willing to carry it and how far some of us have thought this through, but if we're going to treat the meeting place anywhere near like they treated the temple, then if you've got any ailment here or a particular problem with your physical being, you're going to have to go out the door and you're not going to be able to come back. And if you want to take Exodus chapter 3 and use that as an example, or Joshua chapter 5, when you approach this building, what had you better do at the door? You'd better leave your shoes there. And how would you have responded today if I had walked up here with my shoes off? How would you have responded? I think there just may be some inconsistency in this kind of thinking. I do believe that holy people with holy faith ought to be the ones meeting together in this place. They should come with holy thoughts. They should come engaged in holy activities directed towards a holy God. And these are significant things. And if any of them are missing, we've got some serious changing to do. But that's a whole different animal than saying that the place itself is holy. And to say so, I think, may be going just where no evidence has gone before. If you take the kind of thinking that sometimes we may have applied to the meeting house and you apply it to that first century house, what would you get? Here's the house where this family lives. They clutter up the living room all the time because the kids are all over the place and the kitchen gets dirty and messy and mom and dad sometimes get upset with each other and things go on in the living room and the walls get colored on and so forth. And yet this is the holy place. What would we have? I think it just could become very difficult, and I think pretty quickly we might just give up the whole thought. But so long as we've got this building that no one's in for most of the week, it becomes easier to think that way, but it doesn't become necessarily any more biblical. Now that said, I do believe the meeting house should be maintained, that it should never be mistreated, that it should be used circumspectly and with consideration for one another. We do need to show ourselves good stewards of the possessions that we have been permitted to have by God. And the building is certainly one of those things. Yes, we ought to take care of it so that it says to the neighbors we're not slovenly and lazy and that we care a little bit about something going on. But first and foremost, it ought to happen because it's a blessing from God. We need to use the buildings in ways that will glorify God. This is in harmony with the parable of the talents. I don't think the parable of the talents is so much about talent as it is about using the resources God has given you according to the amount he's given. In this country, we've got a big burden from that standpoint. We need to use the buildings in ways that will glorify God. We need to show regard for brethren's convictions and sensibilities. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 2 says, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love. Some of you may be sitting there right now and thinking, John, I don't agree with hardly anything you've said so far. And if that's the case, I hope you'll reconsider. But if after considering you still don't see it eye to eye with me and we were meeting in the same building and a part of the same congregation, I need to do everything I can to accommodate your convictions. If that means, for example, that I need to tell my children to stop running in the building and go to extra majors to keep that from happening, so be it. If it means that they get up here and maybe there's just a handful of people here and on Wednesday night almost everyone's gone, but the kids are up here playing and one of them starts talking to the microphone and I find out that bothers brother so-and-so, I need to make sure it never happens again. I need to make sure that I clean up my pew and not leave it a mess, even though we've got plenty of mess makers. I need to do whatever I can to accommodate the brother, because what's the purpose of the assembly? Edification in love. Bearing with one another in love. Love is not about me. Love does not seek its own. It's about the brother. It's about the sister. So I'll accommodate. It may be inconvenient, but I'll accommodate. I might not agree, but I'll accommodate. After all, who am I to judge another man's servant? I was asked to possibly discuss the issue of distractions in the assembly, and certainly one of the things that comes up when we discuss distractions in the assembly is clothing. Clothing. I was talking with someone just last night who mentioned to me he remembered, and I don't know if any of you here were the guy who did this or not. I don't know that, and you don't have to tell me, but he was sitting in some congregation, and someone I think was up leading songs or something, and their shirt said something like, "Shut up and fish." And he found that a little distracting. He saw a t-shirt that said something even, may have even been a little provocative or suggestive, and he certainly felt like that was out of place, and it was a distraction. I think we first of all need to look at clothing from the standpoint of Christian life rather than Christian assembly. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 9 says, "In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation." Well, John, that's just talking to the ladies. Well, it's looking primarily to the ladies because the ladies are the ones who most need to hear it. Just like it's the brothers who most need to hear, "Don't provoke your children to wrath." Just like it's the brothers who most need to hear, "Don't lust after a woman." Yet those things apply to the ladies. So also here Paul speaks to the women, but it applies to men. Christians should adorn themselves modestly in the meeting house, outside of the meeting house, all the time. Modesty means appropriate. What wins approval? And of course here, primarily winning the approval of God. We know it's inappropriate to cover our nakedness. And nakedness as God defines it. We can't trust the world to define that. We can't even trust the world to care. God cares. I don't know precisely where he draws the line, but we've got some indications in the scripture. Adam and Eve, when they realized they were naked, they went and covered their reproductive parts. They made these aprons. That's what their inhibition said. Cover these. God made them coats, the scripture says, or tunics. The word seems to indicate a garment that stretches from the neck to about the knees. This is what he covered. I think we need to give that thought. It looks like the high priest may himself have worn garments to make sure that part of his body was covered. We need to consider that. Well, that's never a problem in the meeting house. Well, it's been known to be a problem from time to time, and I certainly see it as a problem outside of the meeting house. We need to consider it. We know it's appropriate to make sure we dress in clothing that is in harmony with Christian character, that we're not wearing shirts and with some messages on them that would not please the Lord. We know it's appropriate, I hope, to dress in clothing that does not distract in whatever particular occasion we're in. Tom Woody, you know, if you've ever talked to him on this subject, and I think there's a lot of truth, if it's not all entirely right on this. You know, Tom feels like he's messed up when someone mentions his clothing. And if he gets up and gives a message and then someone says, "Oh, I really like that tie," he feels, "Oh, that wasn't what he was shooting for." I remember, some of you will remember this too, when I was younger and more foolish than I am now, I had a rather ridiculous hairdo, and my hair would get kind of long and puffy, and it was noticeable. People noticed it. And one summer, I had cut it all off. And Tom and I met each other out in Colorado. And one of the first things, we were standing outside in the parking lot, and Tom saw me. He said, "John, I like your haircut. I don't notice it." And, you know, there's good in that. There's good in that. That is what we ought to shoot for when we assemble, I believe. We ought to dress in such a way that we won't stand out for being overly dressy or overly casual. Dress in a way that's within the parameters of the culture, so long as the culture here is being governed by the principles of God. Come in a way where you're not going to have people staring at you. And if that means you need to go ahead and buy a collared shirt, please do so. And if that means that you need to dress down some, please do so. We want to be very sure, though, that we are making our decisions based on what God has revealed. And that brings me to the next point. This idea of wearing your best. And I think it's an idea that's fading. I think the fact that so many of us here are dressed as casually as we are today speaks to that. But I know there are still some who may feel very strongly on this, that particularly on Sunday morning when the saints gather, you need to be dressed up. You need to be wearing, quote-unquote, your best. I don't like that. I think it has multiple problems with it. To begin with, what is your best? See, we don't really wear what's best. We wear what we are calling best at that moment, but some of us are wearing suits that we've had for 25 years and are hanging, and we're willing to spend money on new cars. We don't go and buy a new suit necessarily, and yet we insist that that's our best? Nonsense. If we're going to be in the business of giving our best to God on that level, it's time to go buy yourself an Armani suit. Many of you here can afford it. Many of us here, men, could go out and get ourselves a tuxedo, and you say, "Well, that's ridiculous. Why is that ridiculous? Wouldn't that be better?" Well, no, that wouldn't be better. Well, why not? See, it all comes down to subjectivity. It all comes back down to this tradition I've received, what I deem acceptable, the way it's always been, and therefore that's the way it ought to be. And I think we need to be very careful about that sort of thing and rethink it through. If you'll bear with me, I'd like to read a poem to you. I know some of you have probably heard it before, but it kind of speaks to this. "One day through the primeval wood, a calf walked home as good calves should. but made a trail all bent askew, a crooked trail as all calves do. Since then, 300 years have fled, and I infer the calf is dead. But still, he left behind his trail, and thereby hangs my moral tale. The trail was taken up next day by the lone dog that passed that way. And then a wise bellwether sheep pursued the trail o'er vale and steep and drew the flock behind him too, as good bellwethers always do. And from that day o'er hill and glade through those old woods a path was made. And many men wound in and out and dodged and turned and bent about and uttered words of righteous wrath because 'twas such a crooked path. But still they followed. Do not laugh, the first migrations of that calf. And through this winding woodway stalked because he wobbled when he walked. This forest path became a lane that bent and turned again. This crooked lane became a road where many a poor horse with his load toiled on beneath the burning sun and traveled some 3 miles in one. And thus a century and a half they trod the footsteps of that calf. The years passed on in swiftness fleet. The road became a village street. And this, before men were aware, a city's crowded thoroughfare. And soon the central street was this of a round metropolis. Men two centuries and a half trod in the footsteps of that calf. Bear with me for a little more. Each day 100,000 rout followed the zigzag calf about, and o'er his crooked journey went the traffic of a continent. 100,000 men were led by one calf near 3 centuries dead. They followed still his crooked way and lost 100 years a day, for thus such reverence is lent to well-established precedent. A moral lesson this might teach, were I ordained and called to preach, for men are prone to go it blind along the calf paths of the mind, and work away from sun to sun to do what other men have done. They follow the beaten track, and out and in, and forth and back, and still their devious course pursue to keep the path that others do. They keep the path a sacred groove along which all their lives they move. But how the wise old wood gods laugh who saw the first primeval calf. Ah, many things this tale might teach, but I am not ordained to preach. It's not a perfect poem, but I think it illustrates an important point. We do tend to take things as they were given to us, accept them, do them, uphold them, and pass them on with never a question asked. That is the natural way, and we need to seek to not be natural. Zechariah chapter 7, I think, illustrates this point. If you'd like to turn there, I realize this is a part of the Bible that some of us don't frequent too often, and it's helpful in establishing this from a biblical standpoint. Remember in Zechariah's day that the reconstruction of the temple was well underway, and it was soon to be completed. And the Jewish people, we learn from this chapter, during their 70 years of captivity, had established themselves 4 fast days. They had established a day where they fasted and mourned for when the besieging by the Babylon had begun. They had started a day of fasting and mourning for when these walls had been breached, one for when the temple had been burned, another for when Gedaliah had been murdered. They had all these days they had established and had during these 70 years now been religiously observing. In this 7th chapter, in verse 2, we have a group of men listed who come as a delegation to Jerusalem. And they have come to Jerusalem to inquire of the priests and prophets. They want to know what God thinks about something. Notice their question in verse 3. And to ask the priests who were in the house of the Lord of hosts and the prophets, saying, here's what these men wanted to ask. Should I weep in the 5th month? And fast as I have done for so many years. We learn about the other fasts as the text goes on, but they mention this. Now, do you see their question? They established a fast for their own reasons. There's absolutely no reason in Scripture to believe that God ordained this. They started this special day of fasting. It's gone now for 70 years. And when they start thinking they'd like to stop, what do they do? What was that? What do they do? They go and ask God, do we need to keep doing this? Now, why are they asking God? Who started this? They started it. Why are they asking God? Because this is what we do. We get something started, which we think is a good idea and which may be within the liberty of Christian service. But it goes on long enough, passed down from one generation to another, and then before you know it, these following generations don't realize it's just something we decided and that we could dispense with. It has suddenly become what God told us to do. Tradition becomes God's requirement. Notice God's answer in verses 5 and 6. Say to all the people of the land and to the priests, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh months during those 70 years, did you really fast for me? For me? When you eat and when you drink, do you not eat and drink for yourselves? I don't want to impugn good motives, but I wonder if some of our decisions along the lines of clothing and other things are really driven by the same sort of thing. God says, when you were doing all that, were you doing it for me? Really? Was it really for me? Or was it not for yourself? Your pity party over what you had lost, the way you wish things had been. In other words, it was self-motivated. It was about what you thought was important. And I wonder if, again, that's at the root of some of this. It's that we're interested in making sure that things look like they did 50 years ago, not because that's really what's best, but it's what we like. It's what we're comfortable with. It's the way we think things were best back then. And so we want to see it hit that way again. Now I'm really going to say something. You can do with it what you will. I think that this emphasis on clothing, this overemphasis on clothing, because we do need to pay attention to it, but this overemphasis, this requiring of putting on this quote-unquote best, may be indicative of one problem and may be causing us another. I think it may be indicative of our too great interest in appearance. Jesus said in John 7:24, do not judge what? According to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. James condemned how they would respond to people's appearance in James chapter 2. I know I wasn't alive 40 and 50 and 60 years ago, but I'm listening to people who were, I'm observing things, and it seems to me that what has happened, and it was part of American culture in general, and it got into the church, that we have loved appearance, we've loved to make sure that things looked good, and we felt good if things looked good, whether they were good or not. That as long, for example, as the church service came in, if the building was well-groomed and everyone was wearing their good clothes, and you gave a good sermon and the song service was enthusiastic and everyone sang out real well, and we walked out thinking, that was great, isn't the church strong? Was the church strong? I don't know in all cases. But is it not possible that the church looked strong, but wasn't really strong? What do some of us talk about sometimes? I come to congregations and they have meeting houses this size and smaller, bigger, whatever, and there's not very many people there. And we care a lot about that, don't we? Oh, we just don't have enough people to have church. What does that have to do with having church? But we get this idea that if it were just the way it used to be, I don't know, why were the former days better than these? Better than this? Solomon said, you do not inquire wisely concerning this. Were the former days really better than these? They looked better. They looked better. But were they better? What are you saying, John? People were more moral back then. Well, yeah, they paid lip service to it, and it's true. It was a more moral life. But if the church was so strong, where is everybody? If the church was so strong, where did all the children raised by these people go? Why did they drift away? If the church was so strong, why were there not new converts and place people to fill these pews that once were full? I wonder if we had an appearance of strength, but it wasn't real strength. Yes, there's always been some strength there, but it just wasn't what it looked like. Because we allowed ourselves to buy into the idea that if it looks good, it is good. And one thing I think one reason we may need to really consider how much emphasis we put on this issue of clothing is look where we are. Look at the problems that are plaguing the churches right now. And those of you who are elders and evangelists in this room, you know what I mean. And those of you who have families that are suffering, you know what I mean. The best kept secret in the church today is hurting families. An elder or someone who's in the know can sit in the congregation and look out, and while they all sit there singing the song, and it might look good, know in their own mind, this marriage is just on the brink. These kids are about ready to walk away from the faith. There's these problems. Sexual sin has gained a foothold. I know of at least four instances where some young person who was among our ranks has departed either because of homosexuality or has become homosexual. If you had asked me 10 years ago if I'd seen that, I'd say, no. But it's here. And it took time to get here. People are forsaking the faith. Members are living in apathy, just putting in their time. These are the weightier matters, are they not? What did Jesus say to the Pharisees? You pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and that's a good thing. He says these you ought to have done, but you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. You paid attention to important things, but you didn't pay attention to the most important things. You sacrificed the best on the altar of the good. In times like these, is something like wearing our best clothes on Sunday morning really where we want to put our attention? I guess I think it's time that we gave our attention to more important things. I think having the expectation of dressing in this way that we in the white, middle-class, Midwestern world have grown accustomed to dressing, because you can go to other congregations in the Brotherhood and they don't dress the same way that many of us like to see ourselves dress in the assembly. They don't do that. The culture's different. The world is different. I think having this expectation can be harmful to the cause of bringing people in, which we say we want to do. I know a young man who has become a fine young man. Some of you know him. He was baptized. I don't know if this was before or after his baptism. But he had been meeting with the congregation, and one Sunday morning, he didn't show up. Now this young man did not have much on the order of finances and so forth. He was really struggling to make his way. He didn't show up. And so in the break between the class and the service, I was able to get over to his place and knock on his door. And he opens the door, and he shares with me why he wasn't there that morning. He wasn't there because he didn't have clothes like the other people who in the assembly. Now, in this congregation's defense, I don't know that any of them would have said anything to him about, you know, you need to dress in such and such a way. But that's the world he saw when he came in. They're all wearing their dress clothes. I don't have any dress clothes. I don't feel like I can come. And I told him, we don't care about that. And I believe he has told me that that was a turning point for him. He needed to be assured that this didn't matter. And that's not about me, but it's about this concept. We have a generation now that is completely, completely severed from this kind of stuff. They don't own these kind of clothes. This is not the world they live in. It's completely foreign to them. I think it may seem stuffy and whatever else to them. And yet we want the church to look like that, some of us. What do we expect to do when they come in? Are they going to feel welcome? We want them to feel welcome. We want people to feel welcome regardless of how they are dressed. So, having said that, how do we handle this clothing issue? You've gotten the drift of what I believe. But I understand you may not believe what I do. And from that standpoint, then, I've got to be considerate of you. And so if you feel strongly about making sure that when a fellow gets up in front of the congregation, he ought to have a tie on, I'll wear a tie. There are congregations I go to where I intentionally don't wear a tie. But I'll wear a tie. If I find out that there are multiple people, or there are people who think very strongly, if I'm distracting you right now because I'm not wearing a suit coat, I want you to feel free to come and talk to me about it. We can talk about that. It's kind of a juggling act, though, isn't it? Because if I put a suit coat on, I may repel some others. You just can't please everybody. That's the thing. It's so subjective. Do we see what we mean? It's all based on what I think, what I'm comfortable with. Yada, yada. What's the Bible say? Does the Bible say anything on this issue? Not that I know of. except that we do need to be modest and we do need to be dressing in love. So that's the direction we need to take. Blessed are the peacemakers. Therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify another. Thirdly and finally, 1 Corinthians chapter 14, the last verse in the chapter, after Paul's been talking about how the assembly ought to be handled, he closes with, let all things be done decently and in order. This is his closing statement. This is the cap sheaf on the whole discussion. So it's a worthy place for us to close. I think perhaps when we hear that expression, we normally kind of land on the orderly part. And that's fine to a point. And I think we do a pretty good job on the orderly part. It's been rare, if ever, I've gone to a congregation. There's maybe a few instances, but generally we're pretty good about that. We know the order, we stick to it. People aren't talking over each other, and we're pretty good about that. In fact, if anything, we may over-order things sometimes, not giving opportunity for people who have something on their heart and a man who'd like to share something that morning that he just learned last night and he's not on the schedule. But be that as it may, what about the decently? This word decently means proper, becoming. In the NAS, it's translated properly. In the NIV, fitting. Most translations render it decently, though. Whatever we do in the assembly needs to be decent. It needs to be proper. It needs to be fitting. And we've all seen things done in an unfitting manner, haven't we? We're sitting in a Bible study and a comment is made, and the comment is this open, unconstructive criticism about a particular individual or about the congregation. A heated exchange begins in the middle of Bible study because two people don't see something eye to eye, and so instead of lovingly inquiring and having an open discussion and learning together, we start getting hot under the collar, and this is not right. We've seen venting from the pulpit. We've seen self-aggrandizing remarks. We get up and a man gets up in front and we're supposed to be studying the Bible and in humility receiving in meekness receiving the implanted word which is able to save our souls, but he's up there telling us how great he is in one way or the other. These things are not edifying. These things are distracting. They are harmful. They're not becoming of a Christian and they don't belong in the assembly. Now, for those who teach and speak and do readings and so forth or are publicly participating, you've got the advantage of preparing beforehand, so you don't end up making one of those mistakes when you just extemporaneously said something from the pew. We get to prepare. It's fitting that we should prepare well. How much time and effort, men, do you put into your present presentations? Do you prepare for that lesson or for that Lord's table or for that reading? Do you prepare as one who is in love seeking the benefit of his brethren, or are you just one who's trying to get it over with and think about it as little as possible? Does God look favorably upon your efforts? Do you fulfill what Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 9:10, that whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might? Can you say that? I think it's clear from some of the presentations I've witnessed, and you've seen them too, that little to no preparation has gone into them beforehand. And sadly, this can become a culture in a congregation. It can become the culture. It becomes the accepted norm, where you can have an entire congregation where a lot of the men just come in half prepared most of the time. And it's not edifying, and it's not right. At best, it's disappointing and frustrating. At worst, it leads to foolish and false things being said. And at all times, it does not edify. I think sometimes we're the best argument against mutual edification. We tell people, well, this is how it ought to be and so forth. And then maybe one of these folks from a preacher congregation or whatever comes in to check us out. And Brother so-and-so gets up there, as he typically does. And we're used to him and we put up with him. But this visitor's never seen it before and they're here to check us out. And they walk away thinking, no, thank you. Hard preparation makes for easy listening. Loving preparation makes for edifying listening. God is watching. If I'm going to love and edify, I need to prepare in a fitting way. And I'm not just interested in edifying the members. We're interested also in encouraging visitors to consider their own faith. I was asked to possibly talk a little bit about this as well. Welcoming visitors warmly. You've been to the congregation that does that really well, and you've probably been to the congregation that doesn't. I went and visited a group in the Kansas City area. It's not one of the mutual ministry congregations. When I first moved up there about 8 years ago from Springfield, I went and visited this group. They were having a special meeting. I don't know, it was maybe a Monday night, a Tuesday night, and I went to go to there, and be a part of that, just to watch it. And I don't know if I've ever had an experience like that. Most cold, unfriendly, disinterested in me reception I've ever seen anywhere. And you remember it, don't you? We remember it. And we don't want to be those kind of congregations. We want to be the congregation that at least in theory, that warmly receives the visitors, that says to the visitors, we're glad you're here, we want you to come back, we care about you. And I think that's good and right. And it is becoming of the church's work. However, as I'm drawing this to a close, I really am. Let me throw out something. You heard me going on about the appearance. This idea of focusing on what it looks like rather than what it really is. And I think this is the same sort of thing as well. You know, warm welcome's great. But let's look to our hearts and ask ourselves, why is it that I feel like this warm welcome is so important? Why is it that I'm wanting the church to do this? Why is it that I'm wanting to do this? Am I wanting to do this just so we can build up our church? Or am I wanting to do this so that this individual can come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ? There is a difference. There is a difference. One is self-seeking. One is we want to keep the pews of our church filled. We don't want to see our congregation die. It's very material and self-seeking. The other is, I don't want to see the Lord's church perish in this place. I don't want to see the Lord's light fail in this place. I don't want to see this person die in his or her sins. I, therefore, am going to get out of my comfort zone and show them some love in the hopes that they might come to know the love of God. There is a difference, and we need to look at that. We need to look at that. You hear people say, well, I'm afraid that when I talk with people about the Bible, they might think I'm proud. Well, the best way to not come off proud is to not be proud. And the best way to come off loving and warm is to be those things. He who would have friends must himself be friendly. So, let all things be done for edification. That means that they will be done in love, and love is not rude. Be conscious of God's will, considerate of one another in the areas of physical matters. Yes, the meeting house. Yes, how we dress, and so forth. And make sure that the work you do engage in on the congregation's behalf towards others is work coming from your heart. That you're not seeking your own, but you're seeking what's best for them. So, on that note, we're about ready to sing a song about the prodigal. I would think that most of us, if not near all of us, are familiar with the story of the prodigal son, but I'll rehearse it briefly. Jesus tells us of a son who goes to his father and says, Father, give me my inheritance. And dad divides the inheritance and gives his son all the money and whatever else may have been involved in that. And off his son went and squandered it in prodigal, wasteful living. The son became so bad off, this Jewish son, that he finally finds himself in a foreign land taking care of a bunch of pigs, among the pigs, the unclean animals, and thinking it'd be nice perhaps to eat some of the food they've got. He's left the father. He's gone to live in the squalor of sin. But he comes to himself finally. He hits rock bottom finally one day. He says, I could go back to my dad's servants are better off than this. I'll try and go back to dad. And as he approaches, he heads home. How long it took him, the story doesn't say. But he gets within eyeshot of home. Dad sees him. And a dad who he thought perhaps might not accept him. It was just a shot. And I'm going to try. It's my best hope. The dad sees him from afar and runs to meet him. Falls on his neck and kisses him. Maybe that's where you are today. You were with the Father somewhere along the line 10 years ago, 15 years ago, last month. Somewhere along the line, you forgot the debt of love you owed the Lord. And you started loving yourself a little too much and you walked away. You know, maybe people knew it. Maybe they don't. Maybe you've just been kind of living among the congregations, knowing you're not really a part of it. But it's been eating at you. And you see things getting uglier. They're getting uglier in your heart. They're getting uglier in your life. Your relationships with people are suffering. There is hope. There's only one hope. And that's going back home. The Father's hands are stretched out in mercy right now to those who would repent. The Lord loves repentance. Your sins may have you down, and you may be wondering, can God ever forgive this? But His hands are extended in mercy. Turn from your sin. Turn to Him. Turn today. Wouldn't it be great to walk out that door with that load off your shoulders and that weight off your mind and guilt-free for the first time in all those years? Guilt is a ball and chain. The weight of sin is so much heavier than the yoke of Christ. The Lord's offer is extended. Would you come forward and take Him up on that offer as we stand and sing?